Welcome to the N1C Fireside Chat. We are very excited to have you guys here today. We have a wonderful group of individuals, and we hope to have wonderful discussion too. So I'm going to pass it over to them to let them introduce themselves.
Yes, my name is Rob Collin. I'm a professor of molecular therapies for inherited retinal diseases, and I'm based at the Radboud University Medical Center in Nijmegen in the Netherlands.
I'm Roger Paxton, I'm research manager for the Precision Medicine Institute at Children's Hospital, Colorado.
My name is Scott Henry. I'm in charge of non-clinical safety and PK at Ionis Pharmaceuticals, and I've been involved in the various projects that Ionis has had over the years with direct ocular administration of antisense oligonucleotides, so I've got a strong interest in this area.
I'm Annemieke Aertsma-Rus. I'm a professor of translational genetics at the Leiden University Medical Center, and I have mainly experience with developing exon-skipping therapies for Duchenne muscular dystrophy and the preclinical background.
And it's a pleasure to join you as well. I'm Tim Yu. I'm a neurogeneticist at Boston Children's Hospital, a professor at Harvard Medical School, and the Broad affiliated with the Broad Institute. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you guys all for joining. And Rob, do you want to set us off and set the stage of our discussion for today?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. As said, I'm working on inherited retinal diseases, which are basically, as the name says, inherited diseases that affect the retina, and the retina is responsible for converting light into an electrical signal, which allows us to see the outside world. And by many different DNA mistakes, people can get visually impaired. So I've been focusing on developing gene or even mutation-based therapeutic interventions for different subtypes of retinal disease with a strong focus on antisense oligonucleotides. So I've been working on CEP290, which is now in clinical trials under the name of sepofarsen. And after that, been focusing on mutations in the ABCA4 gene that leads to Stargardt disease. And I would like to talk about a few examples of Stargardt disease in a minute. And whereas some of the mutations that we are trying to rescue are rare, we discovered along the way that we can also rescue mutations that are ultra rare. And when we talking about ultra-rare, of course, the economic aspect also comes into play. So drugs to be developed as a company or as a biotech versus everything that really goes to N of one. So that's one of the challenges that we were facing. And at that time, I think it was a couple of years ago when I talked to Annemieke, and she was facing the same challenges also for other diseases in the Netherlands. So that's why we decided to found the DCRT, the Dutch Center for RNA Therapeutics, to try to use antisense oligonucleotides for these really ultra-rare cases in a fully academic setting. So I think that should be the topic of today. What are we running into in the Netherlands? What are your thoughts about that? How can we learn from everything that has been done in other countries in order to expedite the development of these therapeutic interventions? And what I would like to talk about today is two cases that we are actively working on. Both cases are having Stargardt disease, and that's a progressive type of visual impairment caused by mutations in the ABCA4 gene. Mutations in the ABCA4 gene are recessive, so Stargardt disease is a recessive disease, so you need two mutations of ABCA4 on each of your chromosome. So far, there are more than 1,000 different ABCA4 pathogenic variants known, and that means that you can have 10,000 of different combinations of these variants, and they all lead to a very variable phenotype, so basically every patient with Stargardt disease is different. We have identified two cases with an ultra-rare mutation. One is an adult male from the Netherlands, and the other one is a young Turkish girl. I was contacted by a Turkish mother that contacted me because she had a daughter with an ultra-rare mutation. So for both mutations, we currently are developing an ASO, and we're trying to get to the stage of intervention, but we are facing some challenges that I would like to discuss with you today. Yes, and one of the, I think we have three criteria that we use before we start such a development process. One, of course, is that the mutation should be molecularly eligible for an ASO type of intervention. The second one is that the patient should be clinically eligible. So we are working with progressive diseases. Retinal cells, they do not regenerate. So if cells are gone, they are gone. And if cells are gone, there's no room for molecular intervention anymore. And of course, the third one is that the patient should also be willing to undergo this this experimental treatment. So these are the three main criteria that we use before we initiate the entire process. And so I prepared a couple of questions to be discussed with you. And the first one basically is at what level of preclinical efficacy is needed and what model systems do you need to use before you can, decide to go on with an intervention? So are there any comments or thoughts about this question?
Well, I can start, and then if Tim has anything to add, he can add. I think so. What I usually say is, so the simplest model system that you can use to show efficacy or efficiency, you should use. So if your gene is transcribed in fibroblasts, by all means use fibroblasts and don't do the whole effort of iPSCs. But you want to show efficiency on RNA level, but you also want to show it on protein level. And ideally, you also want to show it at functional level, whatever that means for the protein that is produced. And of course, so the answer to these questions will differ for each of the different genes. But I always say try to go as simple as possible. And then for the question, how much should we go for? I would like to put that back. So what level of protein restoration would you think this is enough to see a functional effect? And I would say try to decide that before you start your experiments. And then when you've reached it, continue, because there's otherwise a risk of you optimizing indefinitely, and that takes time. And with time, the patients will of course lose lose vision. So I think that is what I would suggest. And then I'll let Tim and or Scott add if they feel that is needed.
Maybe I'll add something which doesn't change anything that Annemieke said, but it's just a little bit of color commentary. Rob, in your introduction, you explained your illustrious history working in the space and in working in Stargardt's. And I should just say that in the work that we've done to advance N-of-1 therapies, the type of preclinical efficacy that we've brought to bear has been pretty much along the lines of what Annemieke said. So first, for instance, let's take N-of-1 therapies for CLN7-Batten disease or for ataxia-telangiectasia dictasia as examples. We relied on the fact that using the simplest possible system, patient fibroblasts, you could get restoration of RNA levels, you could get restoration of protein levels. And in both of those cases, actually, we were fortunate that we were also able to get evidence to be able to demonstrate that there was functional rescue of a cell signaling pathway downstream, or cell signaling, cell biological consequences downstream of protein restoration. Where I wanted to actually flip it back to you, Rob, was that the whole field of Stargardt's and finding these types of ASO amenable mutations owes a huge debt to you, because you worked all of this out a decade plus ago, having established for a variety of variants RNA and protein level rescue. And the question is, as a clinician and biologist and scientist, do you think that there are enough examples of cell biological rescue that you can rely on the RNA and protein restoration, or do you need to gather more data? And do you have to do it on a patient-by-patient basis, or for Stargardt's itself? Having the one Stargardt's clinical trial already having been run and with some promising, really promising results, do you feel that it is necessary to pursue functional validation of rescue for each subsequent genetic variant or not.
Which tolerant clinical trial are you referring to?
I was thinking of step 290. I was thinking,
yeah. Not so that's really a different gene.
My apologies. Yes.
No worries. I think that's the crucial part, and also why I wanted to bring this up. As Annemieke pointed out, use the simplest system. In fibroblasts, we can detect some ABCA4 RNA, but protein is very, very hard. We've tried huge efforts. So in order to robustly detect a protein, we need retinal organoids. It takes 6 months plus to differentiate iPSCs to retinal organoids in order to get a robust ABCA4 protein expression. And then still, we can only detect the ABCA4 protein via Western blot or immunohistochemistry. So you can show the presence of the protein, but not the functionality of the protein and whether the levels that we get are enough to restore function. And that's exactly the problem that we're currently facing. Of course, Annemieke pointed out, so how much protein do you need? It's a recessive disease. So if you can get to 50%, you're always good. Based on genotype-phenotype correlations and many calculations that we did, we expect that 25 to 30% of ABCA4 protein is needed before you can rescue a phenotype. And of course, I think the timing of intervention is also really crucial. So it's a very complicated calculation that we have to do. Unfortunately, the protein function of ABCA4 is really integrated with photoreceptor cells, which are the light sensing cells in the retina, the retinal pigment epithelium that's on top of it. So you probably need this really complex system in order to measure ABCA4 function. And so far, we have not succeeded to do that in a retinal organoid system. So I think at one point, we just have to decide like, okay, we see with our ASO, we see a 40 or a 50% of protein coming back. And based on everything that we know, we assume that it's enough and let's just go for it. But I think that's the difficult decision to make. That said, of course, doing nothing is also not an option because it's a progressive disease. And I think that's a nice bridge to my next question, if I may.
Actually, one more comment there.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, Scott.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add, and this maybe broadens it out a little bit beyond your ABC A4 scenario, is just thinking about other types of inherited retinal diseases where you might use more of an RNase-H type of mechanism, you know, and the additional thing that I think as part of the sort of in vitro efficacy profile would just be to make sure that, again, specificity is as part of, the metric that people are using, for splice modulating oligos. It's, less complicated, but
yep.
Our experience, tackling, single point mutations in rhodopsin, for example, it's, one of the big challenges there is just making sure you've got, sufficient amount of selectivity, to whatever the point mutation is. And that's kind of an exaggerated example, obviously. But I would put some assessment of specificity into the mix of your efficacy endpoints and assessment there.
Yeah, totally agree. And then luckily for Stoddard, we don't have to do that. It's a recessive disease and we're purely focusing on spike switching ASOs. But of course, there are other types of IRD that we're working on and that also includes the gapmers. So
yeah, just a little broader context there.
Yeah, no, definitely true.
Rob, I'm in the clinical space. I don't touch preclinical to any great degree, but I want to echo your sentiment regarding timing between sufficient preclinical work and clinical treatment as well, in that we have sort of an adage in Colorado that time is tissue, right? Particularly for these sorts of cases.
Yeah. Yes. Of course, and whereas on one end, there's efficacy, for which we may not know whether it's enough, yes or no. And I think the obvious other side of the balance is safety. So I think similar questions are also opportune here. So what level of preclinical safety is needed? So far, all of our efficacy work is done in cellular models. Of course, we had discussions in the DCRT before to what extent safety assessment in animals is needed. And particularly because in the eye, we need repetitive administrations. So probably ASO injections 2 to 4 times per year. Does that mean that the preclinical safety assessment also requires repetitive injection? Or would a one-time injection be sufficient? I would love to hear your opinion about this.
Yeah, and maybe I'll jump here to lead this one. And this is a one that we've struggled with, and it's really, you know, challenging. And so I think that, you know, the local ocular administration is, I think, very promising from an efficacy perspective, but doing sort of, a non-clinical animal safety assessment, it, you know, presents a lot of challenges just because, rodent eyes in particular, are particularly poor model, in my opinion, for, for doing the safety assessment. And so, I think it's necessary, though, to do some, safety testing of individual sequences. So far we don't have great, sort of in silico models to, fully predict safety. So I think, assuring that, good tolerability of an oligonucleotide is still very necessary in some sort of an animal model. I think the path that we've taken for some of these rare, indications, it is, to try to do it in a larger animal species, but only use very few animals. So I think essentially in principle, I find, more value out of, showing tolerability or establishing some sort of, safety in that small number of animals with a larger eye than trying to do, repeated intravitreal injection in rodents, which I think is just, sort of impossible at some level. So, this is a challenge, and, I think it's, obviously it's kind of hard for me to sort of, real prescriptive with what we've done at Ionis because we've got, more resources. So I think in principle, though, finding some sort of, way to establish some, in vivo, safety and tolerability in, an animal with a larger eye, whether it's a, a rabbit or a dog or something, is, still very necessary.
Yeah. But if I listen well to you say, okay, the autonomy and the comparability of the eye is more important than the fact that you inject 1 or 2 times.
I think, again, you do have this issue, as you say, with long half-life drugs, and you don't want it, make your safety studies take so long, your patients are going to progress, and you're not able to help them.
Yeah.
Versus, treating, an animal too frequently, with, a toxicology study where you're, dosing at higher doses and you get, safety signals that really aren't, that representative. And so it's a tough balance. So this is one of the, one of the challenges. And I think just kind of from first principles, maybe designing a safety assessment that you kind of look for acute tolerability after a single dose, and then have, some, strategy for getting, repeated administration, or just at least, long, readout on sort of tolerability, once the drug's been there for, 3 months or 6 months, whatever it is. Yeah. That's going to be very case by case, I think.
Yeah, is there anyone that would like to add to this? I think it's a very complete answer. So I see Annemieke nodding, so that's good.
I won't have really anything to add given Scott's expertise, other than just to draw out and highlight maybe the challenge here, that in N-of-1 guidance for central nervous system, like intrathecal injections, by and large, the regulators have been negotiating packages based off of mouse and rat data, primarily, without larger animal models. And as Scott said, if it's not a good system and that we need to use rabbits, dogs, NHPs, and the rodents are insufficient, then those are a higher hurdle to, there are fewer suppliers and fewer outlets where those types of studies can be run at high quality. So not so much to add, but just to highlight that's an interesting, feature of going after ocular diseases, is that is that, that you know, we have to think about that constraint. I'll maybe also throw out something a little bit provocative, which is that that some regulators in private conversations have suggested that there is a level of comfort with intravitreal injections that exceeds that for, say, intrathecal injections. They may think that treatments of the eye are more likely to be tolerated than injections into the spinal canal. Curious if folks have opinions about that. Is whether that is data driven, or well, is that right, or is that not? And if it's, or do we not know? And if we don't know, what, how much more data do we need to be able to make an assessment like that?
Well, I think it might also be partly driven by the fact that you have two eyes, and you usually would start with treating one and not the other one. And then, of course, we have two eyes, but we have only one brain. So I think that probably plays a role as well in that evaluation.
Yeah, I was going to make the same comment. So I agree with that. You know, and I think this is, I mean, our experience, you know, and Tim's, you know, been a shining example of this is, you know, if you're embarking on one of these, you know, efforts, you know, engaging the, you know, the regulatory agencies, you know, early, and at least in the U.S., they're incredibly receptive, you know, to considering these types of things, including the ophthalmology division, you know, specifically. So, you know, again, very much, you know, context dependent and making that sort of risk benefit, you know, sort of assessment.
Yeah. No, and I think, of course, the fact to what extent that you can get systemic exposure of your drug is also important. And I think for the eye, I think it's generally accepted that it stays within the eye. And of course, that for an intrathecal injection, that may be a little bit different. But I think what Annemieke pointed out is also a nice bridge to a point that I would like to raise. So the one eye versus two eye discussion that we're already having. So what's typically done in clinical trials, and especially in phase 1-2 clinical trials, is that one eye is treated and the other not. And if you have a symmetric disease development in your two eyes, then the non-treated eye serves as a control, so you can directly measure the efficacy of your drug. Now with Stargardt disease, eyes are not always developing, or the disease in two eyes is not always developing symmetrically. So if you treat one eye, how long should you wait before you treat the second eye? Because the second eye is progressing. And do you need to have your untreated eye as a control? And if not, what would be another control? And I know that's 3 or 4 or 5 very complex questions in one. But I think the concept is clear, the struggling, the one eye versus two eyes. So who can add to this?
All right, I'll chip in some thoughts.
Good.
As a neurologist, but not an ophthalmologist, my thought on this is that there are really two factors that influence my thinking about this question, which is a really intriguing one, Rob. One is efficacy measures. And as you say, the ability to use the contralateral eye as a reference against which you can establish confidence or lack of confidence, or you can assess the efficacy or lack of efficacy of the intervention that you're making. And granted that natural history for different conditions may not, patients' eyes may not always progress at the same rate in the same way, and that's a complicating factor. But to the extent that there is some support that they tend to progress over a long time period in a similar fashion, I have to say scientifically, I find it just incredibly valuable to have that reference that tells you whether or not your intervention is, it gives you convincing evidence that the intervention is working. Now, you need multiple people's buy-in in that assessment, including the patients, because, of course, you know, and depending on the situation, maybe preservation of monocular vision is 95% of the victory. And maybe there are some situations where preservation of binocular vision is really required to have a meaningful quality of life impact from the patient and family's perspective. So that conversation has to kind of be run by and discussed with the family. But to me, the merits of having that are really are pretty compelling. The second half, you could say all the same things except from a safety standpoint. If something unusual occurs in one eye, in the contralateral eye, that could be part of an unexpected natural history. That could be part of the natural history of the disease that wasn't anticipated or something completely unrelated. Having the other eye as a control could possibly give a sense of, it could help you interpret some for future event that would be very helpful. It might keep you from inappropriately stopping a therapy because it might help you figure out that something was not drug related, for instance.
No. Yeah. Well, what would be the time window to check for these safety aspects? You say, okay, we're going to inject 2 times per year because of the half-life of the drug. We think 2 times per year is opportune. And after the second or third injection, you don't see any safety concerns. Is that then the time to say, okay, we're going to start treating the second eye? Or do you let the second eye deteriorate just to enhance the demonstration of efficacy in the other eye?
Yeah,
and that's a problem that we're constantly fighting with that discussion.
Yeah, and I'll chime in. And I think my whole response to this would have been the third element to what Tim is saying, and that is just the tolerability of the drug. The efficacy to me, is something we just have to, sort of trust to get an efficacy readout before you sort of, make that decision about the second eye or how much it serves as concurrent control is, that doesn't weigh so high in my personal, hierarchy of things. Because you're only having one patient, you don't know what the natural history and the progression rates are and that type of thing. So, I think just assuring safety of the drug at the doses that you're using, would be principal for me. And, the experience we have is most of the tolerability issues are going to manifest either, relatively, acutely after, administration, whether it's IT or sub-Q or intravitreal, so just making sure you don't have any sort of acute intolerability or delayed type of safety finding, effect on visual function or something like that in this case. And so I think, waiting, some period of time after second dose, giving it infrequently, if tolerability looked good and you didn't have any, drug AEs, I would start to feel comfortable about, starting to treat, the contralateral eye at that point. That would sort of be my driving thing. And whether you wait some period of time after your second dose or third dose, again, it's going to be kind of a clinical judgment call at some point. But I think trying to put too much on efficacy to sort of say you're interested in treating that other eye because you've got, signal of efficacy, that type of thing is, maybe asking a lot of the system. So,
yeah, that may be true. And of note, we do our FAB for the Dutch patient. We already have him visited the clinic for the last 2.5 years, every 6 months, to really make the natural history. And hopefully by just changing that we can, or demonstrating that we can change the curve of the natural history progression, that could already be a sign of efficacy. And we can do that for one eye only because we have the natural history of the two independent eyes. So that could be helpful as well.
So I agree. And I think that a lot of what this is speaking to from my perspective pragmatically is the study design up front. So what is going to be your primary aim and what is going to be secondary in terms of safety and efficacy and also the importance of bodies like data safety monitoring boards and what have you, to have, that objective third-party perspective.
Good. A little bit in line. So imagine that it's really hard to demonstrate efficacy. So how long can you go on with your intervention before you say, okay, we don't think that it works? And of course, in terms of drug production, I don't think it's a big issue. For me, the most concerning part would be you are perhaps giving false hope to a patient by treating him or her 2 times a year for 5 years in a row. And is there something happening, yes or no? What's acceptable? Who has tons of that?
Yeah, so we've had this discussion within the European One Mutation, One Medicine group. And so I think it's, so normally with clinical trials, you would say start, stop criteria. With new treatments, you would say start, stop criteria. The challenge here is, of course, that it's really going to be difficult because you want to see a change in trajectory for the treated eyes. And I think it's, what I said, it's more like continuation, discontinuation, then start, stop. So yep. When would you still be comfortable to continue the treatment? And I think this is also something to discuss with the patients, with the families, because the burden of the treatment is also on them. So what are they expecting? Is that realistic? And is that time frame also realistic? And just every time have this discussion with, do you still want to continue? And does the clinician still want to continue? So I think it should be a multi-stakeholder choice. And I think, yeah, also just try, what would be a reasonable time frame to expect to see a treatment effect? And just be honest and upfront about that. Because it would be great if in 6 months you can see a treatment effect, but it's probably not realistic.
Yeah. So our expectation is, if we really want to change the curve of disease, it can readily be 2, 3, 4 years. Yeah. So, yeah, good. If I'm allowed, I would like to have one more question on the table. And it's more like a blunt and very open and perhaps innovative question. So we have been discussing, of course, that when we started was NF1, and then you find a mutation that perhaps is in 2 or 3 cases. I think we all agree that that falls under the academic NF1 treatment. And then we came to a discussion and say, okay, if you have NS1000, of course, that will not fit into NF1. However, if the regulators allow for an intervention under an NF1 strategy, why can't there be an NF1 for a mutation that is NF1000, if you get my point? And by that, you build evidence that your drug that could potentially benefit 1,000 cases could work by doing an NF1 intervention. So is there anybody particular that has some thoughts about this? I hope I explained myself clear.
I think it's clear. It's just it's a challenging one. And I think we've had discussions with the European medicine agencies. And, well, of course, in Europe, we don't need them, but we want them from advice. But they have very specifically said, don't use this as an escape to bypass the regulatory system. And I think that is the worry, that if you... So why do we have more flexibility with NF1 or N is very few? Because you will never treat thousands of patients. If you now develop something for NF1 and then you say, okay, it's safe in this person, it seems to be effective in this person, and then suddenly you say, so now we can treat all the thousands, some are bound to respond differently. Some are bound to have side... So it's a completely different ballgame. And I think the follow-up question is, of course, so where is this... Where between the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and the 1,000 is this magic threshold? I don't think we're certain for that yet, but I think 1,000, I would be worried, because you don't want to extrapolate from 1 to 1,000.
No, but that's not what I wanted. So I would propose that you still will undergo the classical clinical trial regime, but because there is one patient progressively or rapidly progressing, and urgently in need of a intervention on the short term, you are allowed to do an NF1 treatment in parallel to all the other things that you need to do that you would normally have to be done. That's kind of the idea.
Yeah, I think the thing I'd add to that is that, as Anamiko was saying, you know, those things that are, you know, more in the gray zone, you know, and when you have a disease, you know, such as Stargardt's, like you're saying, with thousands of mutations, you know, and Duchenne's is in that category, and retinitis pigmentosa is in that category, and you know, so many, this is an area that we're truly, in the field still struggling with. You know, how do you, bring mutation specific, antisense therapies forward, for these patients that, are 200 to 300, when you get down to it, and I think that, this is an area where, the academic and the industry, still need to engage with their regulatory counterparts, because we've found them to be open. They will require more than just the N-of-1. If you're going to do more than, 10 or 15 patients, you're going to need to do more, than you did to get started. But that's sensible, I think. And, and there is some flexibility. So I think a lot of that is still just kind of a work and a conversation that's still in progress. And so people, should be creative and provocative in sort of what they would propose, realizing that they're going to have to have more complete packages to some degree.
Yeah.
But also for this one patient that you then say, we want to develop it quicker for that one patient, how do you decide who that one patient is and who is not? Because if you have 1,000 patients and you say, well, this one, but then there will be one that may be slightly less advanced. Yeah. They say, well, if you do it for that, you also need. So I think this will become really difficult. And I would not want to be the person that makes that ethical decision, who does get it and who doesn't in that case.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm aware that this is a very sensitive discussion, but it would more be to, first of all, demonstrate that that this type of intervention works, and secondly, to prevent the patients that are most urgently in need for this. To if we want to do the full blown tox study and the clinical trial, maybe it's too late for them, and so it would be more to use this escape route in order to give them the drugs that they urgently need.
But the challenge, of course, is that you now call it a drug, but it might not work.
Yeah. No, that's exactly true.
Yep.
But imagine it would.
Yeah.
That's what we're all dreaming of.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think these are the most important questions that I would like to ask. Is there anyone that would like to contribute something? For me, this was very helpful, of course, with Annemieke and also with Willeke and Ipe. We're in touch on a very regular basis to discuss the process within the Netherlands. But I think we can learn a lot from how you guys are doing it in other countries. So thanks for your input.
Thank you all for being
thanks
here.
Thanks for your questions, Ron.
Yeah, a pleasure. And good luck with your patients. You've got some very compelling cases.
Yes.
Look forward to hearing how that goes.
Thank you all.